This is the In Focus podcast from The Hindu.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the In Focus podcast. I'm your host, G. Sampath. The controversy over Kachchat Thivu is back in the media spotlight. With just a few weeks left for the Lok Sabha elections, Prime Minister Narendra Modi raised the issue again by claiming that the Congress, quote-unquote, gave away Kachchat Thivu to Sri Lanka. He also claimed that the DMK, in contrast to its public posturing, was fully kept in the loop as the Congress, quote-unquote, ceded Kachchat Thivu islet to Sri Lanka. The Prime Minister's claims were further amplified by External Affairs Minister S. Jaishankar in a press conference. So this controversy revolves around two bilateral agreements, one signed in 1974, another in 1976, pertaining to maritime boundaries and fishing rights in the Kachchat Thivu region. The opposition has responded to the Prime Minister's allegations by citing the Modi government's own reply to an RTI query in 2015, where it had said that Kachchat Thivu in fact belonged to Sri Lanka. So why is Kachchat Thivu, a tiny uninhabited patch of land, such a contentious issue, and why is it such a contentious issue now? What is its significance for the fishing rights of Indian fishermen? And are the fishing related issues, such as the detention of Indian fishermen by Sri Lanka, really linked to the territorial claims over Kachchat Thivu? We discuss all these questions and more in this episode of In Focus. And we have with us K. Venkatramanan, Senior Associate Editor at The Hindu, who has closely tracked this issue over the years. K.V., welcome to In Focus. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, K.V., to start with, what exactly do the historical records say in terms of each country's claims over Kachchat Thivu? I mean, what is the nature of India's and Sri Lanka's claims over this little patch of land over the years?
It's an interesting question, because we have accounts of what the basis for each country's claims are, but not many original documents are in the public domain. Professor V. Suryanarayan, an academician and an expert on South Asia, has said that around the time of the Maritime Boundary Agreement of 1974, the Union government took away most of the original documents concerning this dispute to New Delhi, and they have been under wraps for decades. In fact, of the two documents that were revealed recently, the minutes of the meeting that the Union government's foreign secretary had with the Tamil Nadu Chief Minister M. Karunanidhi are surfacing only now. No one has seen them, not even those who have written books on it. So the basis for India's claim is that the island was under the jurisdiction of the Raja of Ramna, who had zamindari rights conferred by the British in the early 19th century. Around 1870 or 75, there are some lease documents that speak of the Raja of Ramna leasing out the rights for gathering conch shells and dye roots from the island. And there was also a survey number assigned to it. You know, the Raja Brahmana, even though it's a princely state, it was a zamindari. And India's major claim is that as soon as the zamindari system was abolished, the rights of the zamindari devolved naturally on the successor Indian state, which is the Madras Presidency at that time. Sri Lanka's claim is that the Portuguese had occupied the island in the 17th century. And there is one document issued by a Portuguese commander that indicates that it was one of the 10 islands of Jaffna Patna that, were under their command. Subsequently, in 1921, the British Ceylon administration made a formal claim to it. During a round of talks with British India on demarcating the fishery line between the two countries. Even then, they had agreed that the maritime boundary or the fishery boundary would be on the principle of equidistance from the Indian and the Ceylonese shores, subject to a small incursion 3 miles away from the Minyan line, in a manner that the Kachetivu island falls on the Sri Lankan side. The line will take an incursion west of Sri Lanka or west of Kachetivu. To prevent a collapse of the talks, the Indian side decided not to make an issue of it, but reserved their opinion on it. It is believed that the subsequent decision was not ratified by the Secretary of State for India in London. So the dispute continued for some time. In the 1940s, there were some activities. Apparently, the Royal Ceylonese Navy used the island for gunnery practice, and there was no objection from India. There are a couple of instances, like, you know, when a trigonometric survey was undertaken in 1876 or so, they excluded Kachetivu from it on the ground that, you know, it may have belonged to Ceylon. But subsequently, a station was established there to which the Ceylonese objected around 1910. And this has been going on for some years, but in the 1940s, once again, Ceylon made a claim for it, but there was nearly, there are instances where these claims were not contested. So these form the basis for the claims made by Ceylon. And around this, in the 1950s, Jawaharlal Nehru took the position that it is too small an island which of little value, and that he did not want to make an issue of it with a small neighbor like Sri Lanka. And this thing drifted, but everyone knows that actually it is the personal equation between Indira Gandhi and Prime Minister Sirimava Bandaranaike of Sri Lanka that resulted in India, they did not formally renounce a claim or something, but they agreed to draw a maritime boundary line that will ensure that Kachetivu fell on the Sri Lankan side. No, India's official position is that there's no territory was actually ceded, and a boundary line was drawn to demarcate what was until then an undemarcated maritime boundary. These are all the facts of the case, and much of the controversy erupted only after the signing of the agreement at the political level, and secondly, it became worse after the conflict broke out in Sri Lanka in the 1980s, because Sri Lankan militants began to use the pathway, you know, to retreat into India for various reasons, including, to escape Sri Lankan authorities, for treatment of injuries, and also for ensuring a steady line of logistic supplies for themselves. Because of these activities of the Sri Lankan militants, there was heightened naval presence in the area, and our fishermen began to be caught in the crossfire.
Right. I mean, thank you so much, Kevi, for sort of giving a very concise and comprehensive, at the same time, overview of the history of this entire controversy. I mean, I think the substance of it is basically that India did not cede or give away Kachetivu because there was no prior territorial, ownership of it. It was only demarcated, unless it's demarcated, there is no, unless it's already within a demarcated boundary, there's no question of giving anything away. I think that sort of clarifies the entire, origins of this controversy. Now, coming to the 1974 and 76 agreements, I mean, the foreign minister has claimed, that India or the Congress government at the time gave away our fishing rights in the second agreement, 1976 agreement. Is that correct? And if so, why would we need to do that? And also at the same time, Kevin, I want to just understand, there are two aspects here from what I can make out. One is this whole boundary issue. Does it belong to this country or that country? Did we give this away? That is on the one side. The other side is the fishing rights. And can Indian fishermen go? Do we ever, there are reports that Indian fishermen have been going all the way till the, Sri Lankan coast. So, like, are the two things related or are they two unrelated things which are sought to be linked for political reasons?
Yes. I'll take them one by one. The first question is about whether the fishing rights were given away in the 1976 agreement. once it's a question of interpretation. When in the 1974 agreement, the area of demarcation was the line running from Adams Bridge off Rameshwaram to the Park Street northward. The 1976 agreement demarcated the boundary, you know, southward from Adams Bridge across the Gulf of Mannar and into the Bay of Bengal. When the median line was drawn, the question of fishing rights naturally surfaced because we must remember that there are no international waters between India and Sri Lanka. The territorial waters of both countries, you know, they merge at one point. And therefore, there is no question of having international waters. So they decided to adopt the principle of equidistance while, you know, demarcating the maritime boundary. There are only two references to fishermen in the 1974 agreement. One was a clause that Indian fishermen and pilgrims will enjoy access to visit Kachathivu as hitherto and will not be required by Sri Lanka to obtain travel documents or visas. And the second reference was that the vessels in India and Sri Lanka will enjoy in each other's waters such rights as they have traditionally enjoyed therein. This was the substance of the 1974 agreement, which is interpreted by Indian scholars as preserving fishing rights. You know, this is disputed by Sri Lankan scholars who say that it preserves only the right of access because fishermen, most of them Catholics, have been visiting Kachathivu for one season every year for the Saint Anthony's festivities. It occurs around March every year. A priest from Rameshwaram goes there to conduct the festivities. And the fishermen, gather there to propitiate Saint Anthony, who is the patron saint of the safety of fishermen. So apart from this, India understood it as meaning that fishermen also use it for rest and for drying their nets. So the interpretation is that you can't dry nets unless they are wet, and they can be wet only if they are, there is fishing around the vicinity of the island. But this is disputed by Sri Lanka, and now it has become academic because the use of nylon nets has made it, has ensured that there will be no need to dry any nets. So visits or access, they are limited to the Saint Anthony's feast or the festivities. The 1976 agreement, even though it is only an extension of the maritime boundary line, appears to have, made a modification because it says that each party shall have sovereignty over the historic waters and territorial sea, as well as over the islands falling in its sight of the boundary. And each party shall have sovereign rights and exclusive jurisdiction, over the continental shelf, the exclusive economic zone, and all the resources, whether living or non-living, falling on its side of the aforesaid boundary. So basically, this is some believe that this makes it explicit that there are no fishing rights, because the jurisdiction over living and non-living resources in the area is confined to the maritime side of one's own territory and not the other side. Thereafter, many believe that the fishermen of Tamil Nadu lost their, traditional right to fish in waters on the other side of the newly introduced fishing boundary. So that is the crux of the problem.
So that means it is correct to say that the 1976 agreement did in fact sign away Indian fishermen's rights to fish around the Kachathivu region.
In a sense, you can say that. But it also means that once any boundary is demarcated, sovereignty, springs into play. So therefore, unless there is an agreement on what can be done and what cannot be done by one side in the other side's territory, everything becomes illegal. It is possible to argue that India ought to have negotiated a separate agreement on fishing rights. But at that time, it was probably not thought of because fishing was then confined to traditional fishermen using traditional fishing equipment. The emergence of mechanized trawlers happened in the subsequent years. There were only a few mechanized trawlers, in the 1970s. But then, it was in 1972 that the Marine Product Export Authority was, Export Development Authority was created in India. And they started seeing some potential for prawn and shrimp exports. And then more and more people brought mechanized boats to exploit the new policy. And there was a dramatic increase in India's marine products exports, particularly from this region, in the early years. But it is possible that traditional fishing never evoked any strong objection until the 1980s for two reasons. One is that the Sri Lankan Navy started imposing, a ban on fishing off the Jaffna Islands and the Mannar coast also because of suspected militant activity and to prevent the LTT from running, doing logistics runs to India and back. It was at that time that Indian fishermen saw an opportunity to, they had a fertile fishing ground because by then they had exploited much of the fishery resources on the Indian side and most of the time they had to cross into Sri Lankan territory, for any reasonable catch.
So the traditional fishing activities did not require or did not generally foray so far into the sea beyond Kachathevu, etc.
Even if they forayed, the Sri Lankan fishermen were not bothered because the catch was very small. They did not think that, there would come a day that Indian fishermen would use bottom trawling. There are two aspects to it. One is the use of mechanized trawl nets, which, scrape the bottom of the sea. And the nets have such small holes that everything gets captured, including fish eggs and fishlings. And what happens is that after the catch, they just take away the dead fish and the what cannot be consumed and throw them back into the sea while they take away all the fish in the area. And this was a recipe for very fast depletion of the marine resources in the area. And since the Sri Lankan fishermen are much poorer and had very little access to the sea, naturally, they found that they lost their economic power as well as their fishing resources at an alarmingly fast scale because of the activities of the Tamil fishermen from India. And they began to, appeal to the Sri Lankan Navy not to permit such fishing, and that is how the arrests began. The few instances of, there are many instances actually of the Sri Lankan Navy firing at our fishermen was possibly because the fishing boats of India were used as a cover by the LTTE for its own supply runs. So it was difficult to distinguish between a boat carrying, genuine fishermen and a boat carrying either smugglers, couriers, or members of, the militant groups. That is how all this conflict worsened because of the increasing incident of, shooting, and then there were instances of, the Navy assaulting our fishermen, taking away their catch. And this was, there were multiple reasons for it. One was enhanced militant activity, increased surveillance by the Sri Lankan Navy, and, pressure built up by the local fishermen appealing to the Sri Lankan government and the Navy to stop the incursion of Indian fishermen.
Right. Thank you for that, KV. I think that sort of really clearly lays out the reasons for the conflict here, because when Sri Lanka's concerns haven't really gotten much play in the media discourse around this issue the last week or so. The LTT militancy being a factor, the mechanized trawling by Indian fishermen, which is of a different order of magnitude compared to the poorer Sri Lankan fishermen who could not afford it. That has sort of brought in an economic dimension to the conflict as well. I think all these factors have over the years had a bearing on this issue as well. Now, the foreign minister and the prime minister have claimed that quote-unquote facts about the Kachathevu agreements were hidden and the people of Tamil Nadu were misled, quote-unquote. So, is there any merit in this claim? What facts, if any, were hidden with regard to these two agreements? Were they not public at the time when they were made and announced?
The details of the negotiations were not known to anyone until then. And as I said, the minutes of the briefing that the foreign secretary gave to the Tamil Nadu chief minister have emerged only now. And we should remember that this was a brief prepared by one of those who were present at the meeting for the eyes only of the foreign ministry and the probably foreign minister and the prime minister. It is unlikely that Indian officials, or, I mean, Tamil Nadu officials or the chief minister were aware of how the meeting was minuted. So we have to take the entire minutes for granted that this is how it went. We do not know whether there were anything outside the minutes, whether there was any kind of additional information or input that was provided to Tamil Nadu. But the fact remains that those minutes themselves, you know, contain a very important aspect, which is they made it appear that there were some security and political and diplomatic sensitivities involved in the matter. If you look at it closely, it now emerges that the then Chief Minister, Mr. Karunanidhi, had privately agreed to the agreement or expressed his absence of any objection to the agreement. That is one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that he understood the sensitivities involved and decided not to challenge the government of India's considered decision. There are four or five aspects that were highlighted going by the minutes before him. One is that India had a weak case and that Ceylon government had a better case. This is, I think, whether these are founded in facts or not, but this was the information provided. And that, there are instances of India not objecting to Ceylonese claims. There are instances in which the Ceylonese assertion appeared to be, more plausible than the Indian claim. And they also hinted that there was scope for oil exploration in the area, which was not in the public domain. In fact, there's a specific reference to the Chief Minister asking them, that he cannot take the opposition into confidence in this matter, because it would mean that he will have to reveal that the first mover advantage for exploration of oil resources is also part of the reason for which India is going for this agreement. The first mover advantage in oil exploration and the likelihood of India's weak case being exposed if the matter goes for international arbitration or before the World Court, and the likelihood of other adverse consequences such as China or other states hostile to India taking advantage of the situation. These were the exact things that were presented to him. It's impossible to conceive of a situation in which the chief minister of a border state will go against the center when such are the sensitivities involved, or this was what was conveyed to him. So politically, it is easy for someone to say that he either had a two-faced approach by privately agreeing to the nature of the agreement and in public taking a position against it. But it looks as if there was very little choice in the matter, that government of India had taken a position and this was not a matter in it concerns external affairs and no chief minister can really take a strong position or challenge the center on this issue. That's how the whole thing has come about.
Right. Also, in terms of what India got in return, I think you spoke about oil exploration bids and first mover advantage. I mean, this whole Vach Bank area, which I think Sri Lanka gave up its claim over it also, it recognized, a portion of the Sea of Kanyakumari as coming under Indian sovereignty. I mean, these are, negotiating counters which India has probably been able to use in this agreement, isn't it?
Yes. We do not know whether, this was specifically disclosed during the 1974 agreement. But there is very straightforward evidence that the day of the 1976 agreement was signed on the maritime boundary, there was also an agreement which did not manifest as a pact. But it was an exchange of letters acknowledged by both sides. And the exchange of letters was sent to the United Nations, for its repository of agreements. This contained the reference to, this concerned Vach Bank, and apparently Vach Bank was in ecologically sensitive area, and India did not want over exploitation of resource, but India also believed that there was scope for oil exploration. This is not explicitly mentioned in the agreement, but both in the 1974 and 74 agreement, there is a clause that if any geological, petroleum or natural gas structure or field or mineral deposit extends across the boundary, both sides will reach an agreement as to the manner in which that structure or the field will be effectively exploited and how the proceeds will be apportioned. This paragraph is repeated in both the 1974 and 76 agreement without reference to any exact territorial area. So we should presume that they were open to, you know, the idea of some oil exploration resulting in a successful hit on any part of the entire territory covered from Adams Bridge on the one side to Bay of Bengal on the other, even as far as Cape Comorin. So that meant that, you know, India had probably World Bank in mind. And now that, you know, there are signs that India has called for oil exploration tenders for World Bank, it now appears that it could have been, India could have seen it as a part of, you know, renouncing a claim to one part and ensuring that there were no long-standing obligations towards Sri Lanka in World Bank. The agreement says that the Sri Lankan fishing vessels will be allowed for 3 years from the date of the agreement, and I think a prescribed 2,000 tons of fish per year, and the number of vessels is also prescribed there. Thereafter, they lose all their rights. This is the substance of the agreement. So it is possible to see that, you know, the government of India saw the maritime boundary on one side and the agreement on World Bank on the other side as a composite thing.
Right. I mean, that's, of course, I think you've made it pretty clear, KV. Thank you for that. But also, to complicate this further, this whole World Bank and oil exploration and maritime, geological resources angle, I mean, with the tenders being invited for exploration, now I think when I read reports that the same fishermen for whose cause the government seems to be so concerned about, they are the ones who are protesting against any kind of oil exploration, you know, being planned in this region, for it would put an end to their livelihoods as a fisherman. So I was just also, you know, wondering, so what has been overall the political impact in Tamil Nadu, especially of this issue being raised? Because, I mean, one gets the impression all this is about fishermen and their cause and their security not being detained by Sri Lanka, their vessels should not be seized by them. You know, all those things are sort of in the mix. But what exactly is the sense that you're getting in terms of the politics of this issue?
Okay. One is the emotional and the sentimental aspect of the entire crisis. Now, political parties in Tamil Nadu have always taken the stand that they support the cause of the fishermen, which, of course, is primarily related to their being arrested and detained by the Sri Lankan Navy and their boats being seized. And in more recent days, they are being, you know, imposed hefty penalties, so to say, for the same reason. The concern for the fishermen is on one side. The second thing is that the Sri Lankan political issue or the Tamil Eelam issue has never been, you know, electorally productive for any political party. There is no instance of, you know, a political party gaining electorally from a particular stand or a party losing because of a particular stand. The very clear example is the outcome of the 2009 election. The election took place at the height of the, the last days of the civil war, when the LTT was cornered and the Tigers were close to decimation. And at that time, there was sentiments were running high that the Congress, supported by the DMK, had, you know, betrayed the Tamil cause and was paving the way for a genocide in Sri Lanka. But still, the alliance won about 27 seats or 26 seats in Tamil Nadu, and they also formed the government at the center. In the same election, the ADMK's plan was that the ADMK leader, Jayalalitha, called for military intervention by India to send the troops and create Tamil Eelam in the same way that India created Bangladesh. And this was the standard. That did not cut any ice with the voters. So, and also fishermen, you know, they are spread across the 1,000-kilometer coastline, and there is no evidence that they vote as a bloc. You know, in each area, some party or the other is strong. Fishermen are traditionally supportive of the ADMK for, you know, reasons relating to MGR's portrayal in films. But apart from that, there is no sign that, you know, the emotive issue of Sri Lanka, Indian fishermen being arrested by the Sri Lankan Navy, or the occasional attacks on them, which has been in the past, has any, you know, has paid electoral dividends to any party. That's why I'm really surprised that the BJP, headed by the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister, sought to rake up this issue with the sole intention of, you know, giving the impression that land was given away by the Congress with the connivance of the DMK. I doubt very much if this will have a major, you know, impact on the political scene.
Right. I mean, it is, in fact, quite surprising. I mean, they are considered the most politically savvy of all the parties. And it's a bit of a, you know, surprise why they have chosen to rake this particular issue for the elections or on the cusp of elections. So, KV, Tamil Nadu Chief Minister Stalin has said that the handing over of Kachathivu to Sri Lanka was only an agreement and Parliament has not enacted a law in this regard. So, he also seems to be suggesting that it is therefore quite possible to quote-unquote retrieve Kachathivu. You know, how realistic is this? What does it even mean, retrieval of Kachathivu? Would it even solve the problems of Indian fishermen getting detained by the Sri Lankan Navy, etc., if we were to retrieve Kachathivu, so to speak?
Okay. This demand for retrieval also has a 30-year history in Tamil Nadu. I think on August 15, 1991, the Chief Minister of Tamil Nadu, Jayalalitha, first made the demand, you know, during an Independence Day address. She demanded the retrieval of Kachathivu formally. Thereafter, you know, over the years, politicians in Tamil Nadu have been raising this demand, and Jayalalitha even filed a writ petition to the Supreme Court for the same purpose. Sometime later, the DMK followed suit, and its writ petition is also pending before the court. So basically, the point about this being a mere agreement without statutory backing by Parliament has been, you know, it's based on a certain judgment of the Supreme Court in the late 1950s, or I think 1960. This is the Behu Bari Union case. The government of India had, had an agreement with Pakistan, then East Pakistan, on Behu Bari. This contains some areas falling in, what is present-day West Bengal, or unified Bengal before partition. So basically, when this went to the Supreme Court for based on a presidential reference, because some people wondered whether, you know, this can be achieved at all because of Article 1 of the Constitution, allowing only India to be a territory of states and such territory as may be acquired in the future. So the argument was that the Constitution provides only for acquisition of new territory, but not ceding of any territory, you know. Basically, the Supreme Court verdict by, I think, a 7 or 8 judgment. The crux of it was that, you know, the right to give up some piece of land is an ingredient of sovereignty. A sovereign state can do that. But at the same time, they felt that this can be done only by a constitution amendment. There was an argument that, you know, it's a new law including a state under Article 3, the article under which states are formed or divided or most recently reduced to a union territory. These are all, provided for in Article 3. But the court ultimately ruled that you require a constitution amendment to ratify the Behu Bari Union Agreement with Pakistan. But this, actually, I'm not sure whether it happened at all. And this judgment is the basis for the claim that since Parliament had never ratified the ceding of territory, Kachathivu agreement or the maritime boundary agreement also suffers from this flaw. And therefore, the agreement should be cancelled and India should take steps to retrieve it physically. I mean, this is the line of argument. But we all know it's short of going to war. Awesome. First of all, it will involve abrogating an agreement that will give to an international dispute. And secondly, there is no political will on the side of the government to ever rake up this issue, because the government of India has always viewed this as a settled matter. They said there was an area with no demarcated boundary, we demarcated it, the island fell on the side of Ceylon, and we have nothing more to do. This is the crux of the government of India's position. Realistically, short of a military intervention, there is no means of, you know, abrogating an old matter and abrogating an old agreement and retrieving it.
Right. I mean, thank you for that overview, KV. Now, I mean, this whole question of retrieval, I mean, if we just try to place it in the broader context, why should we retrieve it? I mean, the one of the big answers we get is that it will solve the problem of fishermen. Now, I want to put forward two theses here, okay? One, retrieving of Kachatuvu will not solve the problem of Indian fishermen being detained, their boat seats, etc. And two, the fishermen's problems can be solved without disturbing the sovereignty over Kachatuvu. Would you agree with both these theses, if I were to put it like that? Are they both correct?
I'll explain. I mean, I'll expand on this, why it is so. See, there is a misconception that if Kachatuvu was Indian territory, that Indian territorial waters will extend, 12 nautical miles east of the island. And the territorial waters of India will also expand to that extent. This is not true at all, because as I have said before, there are no international waters between India and Sri Lanka. And the entire boundary is based on the principle of equidistance. Therefore, even if Kachatuvu was with India, you will not, the vicinity of the island will be accessible to India. But over the years, I don't think there is any fishing ground left so close. The fishery resources are actually quite far away from Kachatuvu. They are close to the Malabar coast of Sri Lanka, to Delft Island, which is an island off the Jaffna Peninsula. And there are a set of small islands off there, further north, that is Karainagar, Mandaitivu, Punguditivu, etc. Once our fishermen reach there, they will anyway be subject to Sri Lankan laws, and they can be detained on the ground that they were fishing in Sri Lankan waters. So I don't think that the retrieval of India exercising sovereignty over Kachatuvu will actually solve the problem of our fishermen fishing in Sri Lankan waters. The only real solution is to have an agreement on which both the fishermen of Sri Lanka and India can utilize it in a sustainable way, which means that the Indian fishermen will have to give up bottom trawling and what is called the use of purse-seine nets. Purse-seine nets are like sieves, which are very, very small, and they can only filter out very small fish, very, very big fish. Most of the marine organisms will get caught in those fishes, in those nets. So the use of both bottom trawling and the use of purse-seine nets are banned in Sri Lanka. So the Indian trawlers use banned equipment. That is one of the reasons why, fishing has become unsustainable. And this practice had led to the depletion of resources on the Indian side, and hence the incursion into the Sri Lankan side, and hence the entire conflict. So the idea that by giving away Kachatuvu, India, but the fisherman problem had become, alarmingly big, is not really true.
Right. I mean, thank you so much for clearing that up, KV. I mean, Kachatuvu, whether it is on the Indian side or the Sri Lankan side, it's not going to make any difference to the problems facing Indian fishermen. And on the other hand, if India wants to really, be serious about solving the problems faced with Tamil fishermen in terms of, the conflict with Sri Lankan law enforcement, Navy, etc., then that has to be based on a bilateral talks and for following some kind of, implementing or, drawing up some agreement on what is allowed, what is not allowed, what equipment is allowed, what equipment is not allowed, and something which is sort of lean towards an equitable, access and utilization of the resources in that region. Now, one last question before we wrap up, KV. So, the Foreign Minister and the Prime Minister of India have raised this issue. It goes right to the top of the country's power structure. Now, what are the implications of these two dignitaries raising this? What are the implications for India-Sri Lanka relations? I mean, you've spoken about bottom trawling by Indian fishermen being something, Sri Lanka's are always been concerned about. Do you think this could now become, an issue which is raised more aggressively by Sri Lanka? I mean, I read one report which says that Sri Lankan papers, in response to these claims made by our Prime Minister and Foreign Minister, they are now saying, quote-unquote, that Sri Lanka might seek security guarantees elsewhere if India is not, going to be looking at, honoring an agreement which it had already made in the past.
That's true. I think the implications are in general very clear. First of all, it's very surprising that at the level of the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister being a former diplomat who has also served as a stint in Sri Lanka, he basically is issuing this matter. He has even sought to make this connection between the law, giving up of India's claim to Kachatipu with the increase in the attacks on fishermen. He even gave a figure of how he had replied to Parliament on the arrest of over 6,000 Indian fishermen. That part is true, but to say that, you know, they are being arrested solely for this reason, or the attacks of the last 30 years, the incidents since the 1980s, were only because of that agreement is quite disingenuous. And it's also, you know, it shakes up a long-standing understanding that the government of India will not pander to the sentiment prevailing in Tamil Nadu that the retrieval of Kachatipu is a necessary part of resolving the problems of the Tamil fishermen here. This has never been done at the government of India level before. Whenever the matter came to court or they had to reply in Parliament, they had taken a position that this is a settled matter which should not be raked. Of course, they will have a defense that they are only trying to fix political responsibility on the Congress and the DMK for the situation. But that also means that they are linking the situation to the agreement. This may have some diplomatic consequences. Right now, I don't think the government of Sri Lanka has so far responded, or nor will it respond, because there is a long-standing understanding that during the time of elections, rhetoric surrounding Sri Lanka is a part of, you know, the election scene in Tamil Nadu. All these days, the regional parties were doing it. It's the first time, the national party is doing it at the national level. This is really a surprise.
Right. I mean, this has been a settled matter. At least the agreements have been a settled matter. But the fact that very senior top dignitaries of the Indian government are raising it now is not a good look at all for India. And there could be diplomatic consequences that may not be really to India's liking. Thank you so much, KB, for joining us, for your wonderful explanation of the entire history and the various dimensions of this issue. Pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
In Focus will be back soon with analysis of the biggest news issues. In the meantime, you can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other platforms. Just search for In Focus by The Hindu. We'll see you soon.